Internet Informed, Guidance for the Dedicated Searcher, as read by the author, David Novak. This book is an element of The Spire Project. Part 2, Intimacy. Chapter 4, Identity. Albert leapt at the brigand's mistake. Stepping on the head of the spear as it dug into the ground, Albert swung hard with the flat of his sword, striking his opponent's hand. "Yield," he shouted, so loud he scared even himself. This would become an important personal victory. Back in Toulouse, Albert's father was all congratulations. As judge, he presided over the short trial, and one less thief disturbed the very important pilgrimage route. The town council was pleased, too. Albert confessed to his father how the thief seemed to have tripped, but it mattered not. A tale was told of his strength and valor. The young Albert was named a hero. It was then that Albert was introduced to Captain Robert de Matan. This aging and accomplished officer, often known as El Capitan, looked kindly upon Albert. At his insistence, a tutor was engaged to help Albert with his reading and writing. Once a week, Albert joined El Capitan in the map room to discuss military strategy. Knowing the land well, Albert found he had much to contribute. The city of Carcassonne, 2 days' ride to the south, was growing. The city petitioned for further defensive works, but El Capitan felt the strategic value of Carcassonne Castle was minimal and planned to direct more effort strengthening smaller castles further to the south. To understand why, Albert had to learn about the nature of war. While cities like Toulouse and Carcassonne were the economic lifeblood of the region, no large city could hold out long when outnumbered. It simply required too many soldiers to defend. This was not true for small castles. Perched high on a hill, a small band of soldiers could hold a small defensive structure for weeks, even months. They could protect citizens in times of raids or disturbances and delay even the most determined adversary long enough to raise a larger army from nearby towns and cities to drive the enemy away. Together, El Capitan and Albert discussed where to strengthen defenses. If we are not careful, the word information takes on a meaning of some kind of nebulous fundamental particle. Loose data, unstructured and unaffected by anything else, like driftwood. Like so much driftwood washed up on the shore, we know not and care not where it comes from. It is here. We collect it, step over it, or fling it back into the ocean as we please. Such an image of information blinds us. Every item of information has a history that imparts a wide range of values and qualities upon the information. This history affects the information. We must notice this history if we are to find better information and better appreciate the information we find. Described another way, information is colored by its history. Bias, validity, and other traits are colors painted onto information during its creation. The raw fact is often only half the message. We certainly cannot trust nor discern its bias without seeing color. Albert learned there is more to securing peace than a stout heart and a sharp blade. Sometimes it is the show of force. Sometimes it is the public trial, the commendation, and the planning. So it is with information. There is more to information than the facts contained. Sometimes significance lies in the context, the format, or perhaps some facet of the author and publisher, the source. This notion of context, format, source is central to library science and provides an elegant entree to information literacy. I demonstrate this visually in my seminars. I stand up, typically in a crowded library, grab a book off the shelf, and rip a page out of it. Librarians go nuts at this, but it has great startle value. I then thrust the ripped page into the air and declare, "This is what the internet looks like. We've ripped information from all its foundations, from all facets of context, format, and source. We present it as an isolated factoid devoid of history." This page, this ripped page thrust violently above my head, we do not know if it comes from a book, a magazine, or a diary. We do not know if it comes from a specialist library, a coffee shop, or a dustbin. We may not even pause to think who wrote it. We may never wonder of the publisher and their influence. Internet technologies rip information from their foundations. It separates supporting detail from the document and presents information without it. Indeed, we can even use HTML to frame someone else's page and present a factoid ripped from the paragraph above and below. However, the internet does not remove this supporting information far. It is all there, simply waiting for us to notice it, to reattach the history to the information we find. Every other item of information we encounter in our lives, whether a book by an expert bought at a secondhand bookstore, heartfelt advice by a dear friend delivered over coffee, or the colorful feature article in a Sunday newspaper insert, all this is richly endowed with a halo of supportive detail. Only on the internet do we encounter information stripped of such detail. Only online do we encounter such raw meat. not just raw, but of an unknown animal, of uncertain taste and questionable nutritional value. We encounter anonymous information in an anonymous form without any notion of origin. Yet this ill-informed nature is of our own making. The halo of supportive detail is all there, nearby, each piece revealed at the slightest gesture or momentary consideration. Once we are adept at seeing color and reconnecting history, it's easy. We can even reverse this picture. We can describe the colors most likely to answer the questions we pose. We can then seek the context, the formats, the sources most likely to have the information we want. We can take our first steps towards anticipating information. Learning about context, format, source, learning to see color, is a journey into the nature of information, a journey as applicable to internet information as to library and commercial information. It applies to all information, even asking a neighbor's impression of the next footy game. This journey traverses very familiar terrain. Indeed, try to notice just how familiar it feels, since yet again, we are not learning new techniques so much as transferring familiar techniques to the internet environment. There should be few aha moments, and many more, well, of course, occasions as we run through this chapter. Context. Just as we judge a person by their friends and judge a magazine by its articles, so we judge a web page by the company it keeps. We find it embedded in other information. We find a single work among many. Nearby information informs us. In our discussion of quality assessment in Chapter 3, we interpreted context to mean web pages on the same website, on the same computer directory, and so presumably by the same author and publisher. Such related, neighboring information demonstrates the bias and skill of the author-publisher. Critically reviewed, such information helps reveal information quality. There is, however, another less restrictive, less narrow interpretation of the term context to consider. Location on the internet can mean more than physical locations. We can also describe location in a relative logical manner. Cyberspace is a four- or five-dimensional space stretched and twisted by the humble link. Links draw items of information close together. Once distant and unrelated, such information now sits only a click apart. While perhaps physically positioned on computers located in different countries, once I link to your website is found from mine. We are neighbors, friends even, and this friendship has meaning. Pages linked together are related, but not in the same way as pages on the same website. Clearly, they don't share the same author-publisher. Instead, links make a statement, a kind of endorsement that states more than just nice site. Consecutive links also share topic. I want to suggest a strange yet also obvious notion. How we find information reveals something of the information we find. Like a tourist guide's commentary on a bus touring through town, as we travel, we listen to the subtext telling us of the information we are visiting. We have covered the best part of the subtext already, notions of prominence, Q3 context, Q4 endorsements. Other elements of the subtext are rather banal. Pages found through cool.com are probably cool. Pages found from a primary school child's webpage are probably pitched towards primary school children. This subtext is simply context. The book bought at the secondhand bookstore, the advice from a dear friend delivered over coffee, and the feature article in an insert of a prominent Sunday paper. All this subtext, this context, reveals something of the information we encounter. Listen to this context. It enriches our journey. It offers us a way to refine a search in progress before we look at a page. This notion of context delivers two further gems, too. Two ideas that will help us find better information. The first is the information venue, the internet's equivalent to a specialist library. The second is the link companion, a way to find comparable information. Context has a marketing application, too, the idea of the internet footpath. All three of these concepts deal with pages away from the page we are on, the page next door, pages nearby, or the page twice removed. The approach to our page. Start with the journey. In an environment where we jump from site to site so very quickly, it is tempting to postpone the use of our brain until we reach a page that interests us. Idle until we reach our destination. Only then shift into gear and critically read a document. We can do better. Reach a page by way of an internet directory or recommendation of a global search engine used in a blunt manner, and the page has prominence. It has fame, fortune, and presumed quality. With practice, we notice as we approach prominent pages. We can use this to check we are searching effectively, since we want to avoid prominence to answer certain questions and desperately need it for others. We can also discuss a feel or impression. Something we find on Wired.com is probably fairly typical and cool in a techie sort of way. something suggested by a youth message board on graffiti, probably is cool in a youthful sort of way. CEOExpress.com, connecting business executives to information that matters. Probably directs us to serious projects. A link to a speaker on instant success. Strange how this page serves no purpose beyond directing visitors to their seminar. No review, no advertisements, no saying anything speaks very loudly of marketing. I'm already meeting the speaker, and the speaker has nothing to say. As we move to click a link, the page we are on already reveals some aspect of the destination. This is the magic of context. Step away from the internet, and this kind of information is everywhere. A dusty pile of magazines in an op shop, the reject sale pile of a local library, the swish new digs of an overpuffed friend courting an article in Architectural Digest. Each image I paint has meaning independent of the words that follow. Each image forms part of the message. Such context adds spice. It adds pizzazz. Why listen to a public speaker if we ignore how the speaker walks, dresses, and inflects their voice? Why fall in love if not to see the morning light dance upon the delicate cheek of a lady in slumber? If it's night, light candles instead. Context is the essence of life, and to dramatize this point excessively, we risk stripping that life from internet information when we jump straight to the words on a page without noticing anything of our journey. Learn to notice context. Every step of the way, like a breadcrumb trail, clues tell us what we are about to see. Stay attentive and listen. For example, while search engines speak loudly of prominence, they also speak of a muddy or clean nature, something we will address again later in this book. Briefly, a clean search indicates little confusion between what is and is not on topic. We search, and most of the search recommendations yield relevant on-topic results. A muddy search is the opposite, a search where we find only the occasional suggestion helpful in answering our question. We search, but the search engine recommend mostly inappropriate, irrelevant, or off-topic results. Clean and muddy are traits of both our search and the information environment. It speaks to us of our search words, of the information we will find, and of the wider information environment we are working in. While it is tempting to consider context as a discrete collection of statements, of endorsements, prominence, a clean and muddy nature, there is a holistic nature to it as well. We help ourselves by considering context as full of nuance and meaning rather than a checklist of possibilities. Information venue. One discrete element of context involves topic. Context draws comparable information into orbit together. More precisely, people like you and I link to interesting resources on the internet and in the process draw comparable information together. The best of these baskets of comparable information I call information venues. The information venue resembles the directory, but our focus is on the best list rather than the most extensive. Large global directories do not often make the best information venues. They are fine venues for general questions, but better, more focused lists can usually be found produced by someone with demonstrated experience in a topic. This is fairly obvious, no surprises yet, but watch carefully because one page from now I will rip the carpet out from under you. Stepping away from the internet for a moment, consider the specialist library of a government agency overseeing childcare. This library holds many books, periodicals, and articles on the topic of childcare. This venue for information contains many fine resources and from many fine and varied authors and publishers. Everything relates to the topic of childcare. The Electronic Frontiers Foundation, EFF, is an association deeply concerned with building and protecting electronic freedoms. As a small part of their task, the EFF maintains a well-read and appreciated archive of publications relating to internet freedoms and legislation. The part of this collection at eff.org/privacy discusses privacy and encryption. Since privacy is an internet topic, as expected, most of the material is present in a digital form. The articles, working papers, and submissions to U.S. Congress are all electronically shelved together. Superficially, this EFF collection on privacy and encryption is little more than a list of internet resources and publications on a webpage. However, look closely, and it shares all the same traits as the specialist government library devoted to childcare or the private library of the Association of Wind Power Producers. In particular, all the publications share the same topic. All items are selected and vetted. We should expect a selection bias. Do not overlook this last point. An association of wind power producers may stock their library largely with very pro-wind power publications. This is not unprofessional, so do not consider it a nasty surprise. Selection bias simply reflects their interests. They want quality resources, so shallow and poorly argued publications are not placed on the shelves. They want it on topic, so everything is about wind power. They also want resources that assist them to express their opinion. In addition to many technical and scientific publications, we would expect to see many supportive publications. To counter this bias, merely visit the archive of an opposing view. The most obvious strength of an information venue is that all the information shares the same topic. Next to a book on childcare, shelved in the childcare library, we find another book on childcare. And next to that book, yet another. Now here's the critical step. Find a book we like. If we look around and notice we are standing at the shelves of a specialist childcare library, not only have we found a book we like, we have also found a collection of other books on the same topic, many we will probably like as well. And let me phrase this using our new vocabulary. When we find an internet document we like, we can use the context of this document to find comparable resources. Welcome to the Link Companion. The Link Companion. Book in hand, we look up and notice we stand at a library shelf stocked with other books on the same topic. Like our earlier examples of local context and endorsements, here again is a simple, almost obvious, empowering observation. According to context, an internet document sits close to a great many places, any place that references it. In the same way, a booklet of events in my city sits on the shelf of the Tourist Information Center, sits in the lobby of a backpacker's hostel, and lodges with other brochures in the state library. Some of these locations are information venues, sites that specialize in bringing together fine resources on a particular topic. If we can find an information venue that references a fine document we like, we have found a list of comparable resources. With one good resource and the help of an information venue that references it, we can find other similar documents. We can't do this easily in real life, but on the internet, this is simplicity itself. Three steps. Step 1, select a good document on a topic that interests us. Step 2, retreat to a suitable information venue that lists this initial document. Step 3, move forward to other comparable resources as listed in the information venue. Look first near where the reference appears to our initial document. Once you do this a couple times, you will see that it really is a simple process, not cumbersome, just counterintuitive. We essentially move backwards, then forwards again. We zigzag through the internet. As our example, suppose we find and devour the delicious Internet Privacy FAQ. We want further resources of similar caliber, so let us use this FAQ to find another resource or two on the same topic. Step 1, search for sites that link to or mention this FAQ. We search for, quote, Internet Privacy FAQ, close quote, or, quote, www.faqs.org/privacyfaq/, or link, colon, faqs.org/privacyfaq, or we simply click on the endorsement bookmarklet. Step 2, choose a promising information venue. Third down the list, I see the about.com's list on privacy. It links to the Internet Privacy FAQ, which is why it appears on the list. Step 3, browse about.com's list for similar resources. For our second example, the Electronic Frontier Special Library mentioned 2 pages ago will prove helpful. Say we find and read the work of the Privacy Foundation, privacyfoundation.org. It is good, but incomplete for our purpose. We want more on this topic. We want other comparable resources. To find them, we look for places on the internet where the Privacy Foundation is mentioned. We look up from reading the Privacy Foundation and notice where we are. Crowded around us are hundreds of assorted web pages, several of them information venues, that mention or reference this website. One place among these many sites is the Internet Privacy Archive of the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. To use our metaphor, we look up from reading and see if any specialist libraries happen to have a copy of the Privacy Foundation material. To our delight, we find the Privacy Foundation sits on the shelves of the EFF Privacy Archive. The EFF also happens to shelve 2 further documents immediately beside their copy, well, reference, of the Privacy Foundation: the U.S. Congressional Internet Caucus, and the Presidential Privacy Archives. These are comparable publications, according to the editor of the EFF's Internet Privacy Archive. These are 2 similar resources, similar to the Privacy Foundation Archive. I use the term link companion to describe this relationship. 2 resources are not linked together. The Privacy Foundation does not link to the Presidential Privacy Archives, but links to both appear together on the referencing page of the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. They are tied together. The EFF shelves them beside one another, mentions them in the same breath. They are linked once removed, as it were. They are second cousins. The link companion emerges from a wider view of context. Information we find on the internet is positioned close to many other resources all over the internet, anywhere it is linked or mentioned. The Privacy Foundation is on the shelves of the EFF Archive, the shelves of the Yahoo List of Privacy Resources, on Joe Nobody's personal page, and many further pages across the internet. That its physical location is at a specific web address on a specific computer is unimportant. Logically, the Privacy Foundation is next to other sites that in turn link to comparable resources. I first uncovered the Link Companion 3 years ago while observing reference librarians of the Western Australian State Library as they provided online assistance to users at the Australian Ask Now service. The reference librarians are charged with leading internet users to at least two resources that should answer or at least advance their question. The Link Companion became a way to turn one good resource into a list of further likely resources to consider. I have 5 pieces of advice to share about Link Companion. Firstly, using Link Companions is a genuinely alternative way to move through the internet. Instead of searching for information based on criteria we supply, we spot one site or resource we like, then gather comparable resources based on someone else's reasoned personal assessment of what is similar. We reach very different material in this manner. Secondly, this technique feels much like the constant surfing of further resource pages once so familiar to early internet users. Once upon a time, 8 or 9 years ago, surfing was a valid way to find information. Early web publishers took great pains to alert us to the best comparable sites, and who better to decide what was significant than those who publish on that topic? We cannot do this anymore, since so few publishers put much effort into further resource pages. However, Link Companions serve the same purpose. Thirdly, this is not a cumbersome technique. We essentially zigzag our way through the internet. Instead of stepping forward to the next page, we step backwards, then forward again. Once we have our work desks set up properly, the topic for Chapter 5, this will involve only a click on a bookmarklet, then a glance at a list of candidate venues. Seconds, not minutes. Fourthly, this technique only works well when we have a great initial page to work from. We want a page people talk about. We want a page that almost tells us what we want to know. If we just grab Link Companions for the first page we come across, better to just toss words at a search engine. Lastly, we also want to choose a fine information venue. The best Link Companions come from information venues created by publishers strong in their topic. This is not usually the larger global directories like Yahoo Directory or the ODP. A good page for Link Companions, very much like a fine specialist library, is often not particularly famous, but has that ever so desirable quality of specialist experience. With our last example, just how helpful the EFF's list of privacy resources will be depends on how much care goes into the preparation of their list of resources, on how the archive is organized, and a few other conditions. The more effort the EFF puts into their list, the more likely it will become popular and prominent too, but that's a different issue. Prominence depends more on reputation of the EFF, the time it has been online, and any past promotion of the archive, not just on intrinsic excellence. The most promising venues will tend to stand out from a list of links once we learn URL interpretation from Chapter 7. They look like lists, not articles or discussion pieces. Better Link Companions come from sites produced under the Utopian publishing model, more on that later, from sites that show a selective approach to linking, and from sites that demonstrate their experience. In practice, I gather Link Companions only when I have a specific need, not a general interest, and only when a specific search proves clumsy or muddy. If my interest is general, I will just search for a prominent site instead. If I want an alternative viewpoint, then I do not want a comparable site, and Link Companions would not help. If my search descends into a hunt for a good resource, I stop and try another way. When you first search for Link Companions, you may find it confusing, no better than simply tossing keywords at a search engine. Do persist. At times, this is a very elegant way to search. It's worth our time learning when Link Companions work well and when they do not. I find Link Companions either help quickly or not at all. I use this technique in perhaps just 5% of my searches, but with splendid results. Almost all internet information will have Link Companions, just as all published information away from the internet usually lodges in some folder, bookshelf, or specialist library. It is the magic of the internet that allows us to know where information lodges with so little effort. And where it lodges, we find other resources on the same subject. Our next topic deals with what we actually find and echoes once more how the real world and the internet behave in much the same manner. Format. Information weighs heavily in our lap, blasts in our ears, and assails our eyes. We easily categorize information by how it reaches us, by its presented appearance. This is a printed book. That is a newspaper. Please speak quietly so I can hear the news on the radio. We easily classify information in this way. Far more significantly, look at how information is prepared. We will use the term format to describe a very specific vision of these forms, a vision that divides books from articles, from research reports, press releases, sales brochures, memos, and discussion items. Each format is different, distinct, and provides clues about the information within. There is one critical point to this definition. Format is not tied to the physical presentation of the information. Format describes the logical preparation. When I mention a book format, I'm not referring to the physical object, a heavy bound pile of compressed tree pulp full of words printed in ink. Instead, I refer to the concept of a book, a lengthy document prepared by an author, carefully edited, then published by a publisher with a profit motive. The list of formats does not include internet, digital, and print. These words describe presentation. Format is not tied to specific internet tools either. There is no email format, no database format, no web TV format. There is especially no web format. Because of this, format is distinct from file type, from doc, PDF, HTML, text file, and PPT. File type is one of the minor fields found on some global search engines. A Google search that includes file type colon PDF will reveal just the PDF files matching our query. But PDF is not a format. PDF is the manner the information is presented, not the manner it was prepared. Format, so defined, is a powerful concept. It ties our experience with non-internet information directly to the internet world. A book, whether presented as a physical object or an electronic version, embodies all the same qualities and characteristics. Both are lengthy documents prepared by an author, carefully edited, and published by a publisher with a profit motive. News articles, whether in print or online, have the same qualities. Both are short, sharp, abundant, timely, and of less than certain factual quality. These qualities emerge from how the information is prepared. These qualities are inherited from the process that brings the information into being. I mentioned that format is distinct from internet tool. We access the internet using tools with names like File Transfer Protocol, FTP, Telnet, Newsreader, and Web Browser. New tools continue to emerge with names like Internet Relay Chat, BitTorrent, and RSS newsfeeds. Each tool uses a particular protocol, may have custom-built software, and may share common qualities. Thus, when an internet address starts with FTP, the hallmark of an FTP resource, we can make several assumptions about the information. Indeed, all FTP resources share some qualities. They all look alike, for instance. In the early days of internet searching, the internet tool was very significant in searching, but this concept has become too clumsy to tell us much anymore. Information moves from one tool to another too easily. Shareware, once distributed almost exclusively by FTP, is today largely retrieved through the web. Shareware is a manner of preparation, a format. FTP is an internet tool, one among many we can use to retrieve shareware. We could say email is a format, and probably will by mistake. To be precise, the format is the memo or note. All memos bear similarities in how they are prepared. This difference is clearer once we look at the SMS, short message service, a format as well as a tool. The SMS is a small text message, painfully punched into a mobile phone touchpad and intended for convenient retrieval by another mobile phone user. At the same time, the SMS is largely tied to the mobile phone. Of course, I can also send SMS messages from a web page, courtesy of my internet service provider. I wrote a computer script that relays seminar reservations to me via SMS, making use of a commercial SMS gateway. At the same time, my phone company lets me send an SMS to an email address. With this in mind, if I send an SMS message from a web page to your email address, where is the mobile phone? Is it still an SMS? The message certainly resembles an SMS. A very short text coded with funny misspellings like U instead of Y-O-U. I prepare the message in an SMS format. It just reaches you without ever touching a phone. This separation of tool from format occurred some time ago with the fax. I may prepare a fax that never touches a fax machine. I scan a document, send it by email to a fax gate, and from there to your fax number, which may be a virtual fax, meaning the document reaches you attached to an email address. No fax machine, no paper. Yet it is still prepared in the fax format, a black and white graphical representation of a page of paper suitable for signed legal documents. The presentation changes, the manner of preparation has not. In an earlier era, we paid great attention to tool and file type. We classified information this way. It was part of our excessive focus at the time on the internet as an extension of computer science. Unfortunately, this had the unintended effect of distancing internet resources from almost identical non-internet resources. It failed to present the internet as an extension of the information world. Ebooks are not books. Certain web pages are not articles. Instead, attention to presentation directs us to what all web material has in common, except that pretty much anything can be presented as a web page or embedded in a web page. Knowing it as a web page tells us exactly nothing. There is no format called the web. The web is a voracious creation consuming and presenting information from so many formats. Newsgroup discussion can easily be retrieved through the web thanks to Google Groups, a powerful searchable database of newsgroup discussion with an esteemed lineage. Email posted to a mailing list often gets archived. We can view it as a web page. Does this somehow change the qualities of the discussion item when we see it as a web page? Clearly not. The notion of format structures this story differently. Almost all information exists before it exists on the web, perhaps as an article, a patent, a report, a book, or a news item. Even when no prior existence can so clearly be identified, the words and ideas are prepared in a way almost identical to a non-internet method, perhaps as a sales brochure, a book, a phone call, or a memo. As we follow this logic, the internet becomes an extension of the larger, grander information world. We tear down the walls attempting to convince us that the internet is something completely new, something for which we have no useful prior experience. Format is elegant. Internet information is deeply organized by format. In research, we often start by judging the format we want for the information we seek. We may also find it helpful to predict the format our answer will most likely take. As we proceed, I will show you how the format can often be guessed from a great distance, if not from the web address, then certainly from a quick glance at the page. Later, when we discuss the sociology of information, this notion of format permits us to watch the migration of information from print to the internet and how various formats compete for relative dominance. We can argue another time if the web has spawned any truly novel formats. The blog, a special kind of online diary, certainly seems unique. We can also argue if all online information shares certain traits that make it distinct from their non-internet brethren. Immediate access springs to mind as a defining feature. However, at this moment, let us just explore this concept of format a little further. The book. Books have such meaning. They symbolize distilled knowledge. They signify expertise. We are emotionally invested. Rip a book in public, an old book with just one interesting chapter. Tear out the pages, and even strangers will loudly express their exasperation. Yet books are just one distillation of knowledge. Books are large, lengthy tomes, heavy with depth and detail. They lack sharp criticism and cannot address emergent trends. In research, they ideally suit general questions but make horrible resources at other times. Much is right about books, but for each brilliant quality, they suffer a significant shortfall. They are old. They date badly. They have a limited lifespan, yet physically last much longer. They are long, troublesome things to read. They cost money. These qualities emerge from the way books are created. An author gives birth to a book, investing a great deal of time preparing a lengthy tome. The size of the book allows for far more detail than other information formats. This size drives the author to present a complete, balanced, and holistic perspective. The author and editor both invest considerable time preparing the best quality possible. Spelling and grammatical errors are unacceptable. Equally so are legally gray accusations, poorly constructed logic, fluffy narratives, and amateur translations. The publishing of a book involves many people working together to create and present a lasting document of considerable length. There are financial considerations. The work, above all else, will be sold, perchance, for a handsome profit. A book usually becomes available to read at least a year after the publisher enters the scene, and the finished product is not created in the month preceding its delivery to the publisher. Many books have their origin 5 or even 10 years earlier. This book began with a seminar delivered in spring 2000. Such lengthy preparations is sharply at odds with other information formats. A press release or news item may be created the very day we read it. In summary, the book format tends to be old and detailed. It excels at presenting a considered overview. The press release. The press release is a document either promoting an organization and its accomplishments to the media, or explaining and mitigating a potential public relations disaster. The document's purpose is to entice the media to write a story. Thus, the press release tries to capture fleeting attention with a catchy title and an engaging storyline. It then provides the background a journalist would need to write a story. Catching the eye of a journalist is not easy. Too many organizations in our world would love to have more positive media stories about their accomplishments. This market is highly competitive, and news writers are very bored. Tens of hundreds of press releases will cross their desk daily. From their attention overload arises a highly structured format that helps the journalist quickly scan for relevant information. Each element is highly dictated by custom and purpose. A little less than a page in length, start with the organization issuing the statement and a date. Short, sharp, one story and one storyline only, described in a few words. Press releases are distributed in three ways. Firstly, they are faxed and emailed to specific journalists. One task of a public relations department is to cultivate press contacts, and once cultivated, bury them in press releases. Secondly, businesses called wire services specialize in distributing press releases to the media. Business Wire and PR Newswire are some of the largest. For a substantial fee, wire services will include a press release and a daily ritual with hundreds or thousands of other press releases made available to the media around the world. There are smaller newswires to fax or email our press releases to journalists in our area or journalists in our field. TechWire, UWire for university campus papers, VentureWire for venture projects. The Yahoo directory keeps a long list of such wire services. Each, for a fee, will distribute our press release in the often vain hope that the media scanning today's list will rest an eye on ours and write a story. Thirdly, press releases are archived as an information resource. They often appear in the media section of large corporate websites. Internet search engines index some, and commercially prepared company profiles may include press releases as well. The larger wire services archive past press releases in vast commercial databases that stretch back years. The press release is a highly specialized format designed to capture the attention of an audience of journalists mildly interested at best. It is a format that demonstrates focus and tries to promote. The newspaper. Perth, Western Australia has a single dominant daily newspaper called the West Australian. It costs $1 and is available for home delivery. Perth also has a collection of free newspapers delivered to specific suburbs. Where I once lived, we received the Guardian Express, the Voice News, and several further free newspapers like The Wax, West Australian Explorer, Out in Perth, Shout, and The Parents Paper. These four focus on events in Perth and come out less frequently. With just over a million souls, Perth has just one prominent daily newspaper. Why? The answer is a tale of business development, a tale best told from one business coach to another, describing how newspapers build, purchase, and struggle to attain primacy, then defend their position, as businesses do, ensuring other daily newspapers cannot succeed. From a searcher's perspective, the existence of just one prominent daily newspaper is of considerable importance. If we are interested in a regional approach to information, the newspaper ranks very high as an avenue to explore. With just one prominent newspaper, we have only one door to open. That Melbourne retains two significant daily newspapers should not cloud the importance of this generalization. A daily paper does not present the same news as a local fortnightly free newspaper. They differ significantly, and we know this already. Consider the world news section of the newspaper. International news reaches us at the end of a sophisticated chain of supply, with information swept from a far-flung journalist to our local newspaper. Journalists submit an article to a newswire. Newswires sell subscriptions and reprint rights to local newspaper editors. Editors select news and incorporate it in their world news section. Your local newspaper has many staff writers for local news, and these journalists may in turn occasionally submit articles to newswires when international interest exists. Your local newspaper has few staff writers in foreign locations. Most foreign news emerges from journalists with little or no relation to the newspaper we read. Many of these foreign articles are attributed to AP, Associated Press, or the New York Times, or another of the international newswires. A lovely twist to this supply chain occurred early in the life of the Internet, when these international newswires began publishing their stories directly to the Internet. They essentially began competing with the newspapers they supplied. Various market approaches were tried to move news directly from newswire to consumer, but they did not work as effectively as the existing journalist, newswire, newspaper system. Agence France-Presse, the primary French-language newspaper, eventually withdrew from publishing free to the Internet. Today, news is readily available from newspaper websites and various portals. We shall continue this story later, but the significance of newspapers rests in how this structure occurs in all cities. Everywhere, the newspaper has a similar role to society, a role driven by the nature of newspaper news, by how it is created and distributed. Serial brochures. A very different mechanism is at work with the serial brochure. Here, financial concerns are not paramount, certainly not at the start. There are expectations of financial justification later down the track, but when they begin, the advertiser-publisher is willing to gamble. Thus, we have periodicals sent to us by our phone company, by our bank, and if we have a new child, then by our baby food supplier, too. Unfortunately, this type of information suffers badly from poor editorial concerns. The information is so completely biased by the interests of the publisher that the information is almost useless. And because the audience is characterized in such a superficial way, all telephone users, all parents with young kids, the information contained in these periodicals tends towards being general and superficial. Further, since the content is intended to represent the company, there is a serious avoidance of contentious or confronting information. Over time, as the financial returns weigh more heavily on the management of serial brochures, the quality of the articles, the quantity of advertising, and the acceptance of far more advertorials and similar steps reduces the package as a whole. As an information consumer, I look to these periodicals with disdain. As an aside, this is often the same trajectory of many websites. Much of the internet is prepared in this format. Not that such an effort need be so poorly executed. There is no need to limit such a periodical to just one advertiser. The publisher can improve the content in ways to interest further advertisers. The difficulties that plague the system of communication can be surmounted. We know this because of the in-flight magazine. The Australian airline Qantas publishes a monthly magazine of very high quality. They pay international authors good money for good articles, though often buying only second or third rights. The articles have been previously published elsewhere. The audience is interested in travel and is generally wealthy. The magazine carries excellent articles on travel destinations and enjoys abundant advertising from a range of top-end retailers. Thus, with a captive audience, a wealthy audience, and with good advertising and minimal distribution costs, Qantas has a success. Indeed, the abundance of advantages contributing to the success may highlight the difficulties in presenting a meaningful serial brochure. Most serial brochures do not have such abundant advantages. Few serial brochures reach such lofty heights. A multi-format world. Newspapers, press releases, books, and articles. The information world has not always been so complicated. Complexity is a gift of the postmodern world, as are a multitude of new formats it makes possible. If we look way back in history, back when few people could read, the popular modes of communication were few indeed. The troubadour, the orator, and the sermon. Egyptian scribes allowed for popular use of the written language, and we have an abundance of tender letters, banal receipts, and religious writing to attest to this. Consider the format of the etched stone slab prominently displayed for public attention. Hammurabi's Code of Laws, circa 1780 BC, according to the Louvre, is a black slab of basalt etched with a very early legal code. King Hammurabi arranged for such monuments to be placed in prominent and frequented locations throughout his kingdom, and so reach his subjects. The famous Rosetta Stone, a message in three languages, is a similar later example. Art conveys messages too. A lord, cardinal, or pharaoh, depicted in some act of devotion beside instantly recognizable religious personalities, conveys greatness and piety. Such leaders obviously deserve respect and loyalty. After all, how many of your friends have archangels personally arrived to chaperone them to heaven? Many a Gothic painting shows just such a scene. We see this again in the deep relief carving of an Egyptian pharaoh in the company of gods, blessed by the warm hands of the sun. Modern painting often tells exquisitely confronting social messages. Francisco de Goya's painting, The Third of May, 1880, Executions on Precipice Hill, chronicles the horror of Napoleonic troops oppressing occupied Spain. This picture is far more eloquent than any book, statue, or slab of basalt. Here in Australia, I remember the modern art installation, Christ in Piss. The piss, I vaguely recall, was revealed as lemonade only a year later. Great controversy surrounded this art piece. It cleverly challenged viewers to consider their response to religious heresies. Art can be a very sophisticated medium of communication. Works of art, slabs of granite. What has developed over the last few millennia is a focus and clarity to our communication. Modern and postmodern formats like the press release and the blog are highly focused and efficient. Over time, formats also change. Painting, once a method of realism, was pushed firmly into the realm of art. The discussion piece drifted into the electronic world, collecting and perfecting a sense of immediacy and an invitation for public comment. This vision of format is immensely potent on the internet for two reasons. Firstly, much of the internet is organized by format. Start with a book in mind, and we certainly have a clearer idea of a path and destination. Significant book databases spring to mind, like Amazon.com's book database, the Catalog of U.S. Government Publications, CGP, the library catalogs of the great national libraries of the world, and the commercial database World Books in Print. Similarly, if we decide to chase an article on Kashmir in a political science journal, we have already sketched our journey in the sand. There are lists of such journals, established ways to find them, and a certain look and feel to such resources. We know the path forward, and this path has little to do with approaching a global search engine with several keywords in hand. Secondly, once we determine the format of a given web page, often before we even look at a web page, we know many of the qualities we will find. Newspapers are current, light, biased, and abundant. Books are old, detailed, considered, and overview. Recognize a web page was prepared as a news article or a book, and we know so much about the information within. Recognition is the key. Recognize the format of information we encounter, and recognize the format we seek. Let format guide us to the information we seek. Before we continue this discussion, however, we also want to recognize the author and publisher as well. Source. His fame was short-lived. Strike, parry, thrust, Albert spent much of his fourth year hating his profession. The physical effort left him constantly exhausted, as he learned just how unskilled he was with the sword and bow. Furthermore, his skill did not improve much as time passed. Respect from his peers came only later, paradoxically, once he no longer sought it. On his first military campaign, he realized just how little he did know of soldiering. Spending so much time preparing and waiting, he grew to understand how patience was as important as how he held his weapon. After Albert returned, scarcely having seen the enemy except in the distance, he grew more at ease with waiting. He relaxed into the task of learning how to defeat an opponent with a sword. He also grew resigned to the knowledge that he would be lucky indeed if his ultimate death had anything to do with the sword. Most likely he would die of a horrible disease brought on by poor food and shelter, waiting for a battle to begin. The author writes. The author perches lightly on the edge of a chair, delicately scratching on a pad of paper. Or perhaps the author lounges along the length of a sofa like limp salami, banging away at a keyboard. The author's words appear in the finished product. The author's nuances enliven the work. The author's depth of understanding reaches us through the writing. The author's bias colors the words. Authors wield tremendous influence over the information quality. These qualities are varied and include such aspects as spelling and punctuation, plot development, metaphors, logic, persuasiveness, and more. An author may try to convince us with an impassioned plea, a quilt of circumstantial evidence, or a logical mathematical style proof. This reaches beyond how it is recorded to touch on what is recorded. Personal bias, exaggeration, and the selection of statistics may generate a biased view. These influences originate in the author. Authors choose words. These choices also reflect on the author. We make certain judgments about information based on their author. We make judgments about an author based on their writing. Creator and creation are interrelated. Is the author excessively biased or deeply flawed in some way? One simple approach to answer this question is to assume the author is professional and knowledgeable. Now downgrade this assessment each time we see poor spelling, bad grammar, leaps of logic, or convoluted twists that do not ring true. As our impression drops, we move closer to just discarding the work and considering the author a crackpot or a naive idiot. We reach a point where we are unwilling to believe their scholarship. Under other circumstances, we approach this completely the other way around. Authors must prove quickly that they have the professional experience and knowledge to be responsible. What are their credentials? Are they new to this field? What else have they accomplished? What do reviewers tell us? If not suitably impressed quickly enough, we discard the author and their work as too amateur to be of value. Thankfully, there is more to judging authors and information. There are vast vetting systems to limit the audience of a poor and confused writer. To publish a journal article, we must first convince an editor and knowledgeable peers. To publish a book, we must usually convince a publisher to risk money on our creation. Vetting is important, but in no way does this diminish the importance of the author's craft, nor diminish the importance of us asking about the author. Now let us consider the publisher. A publisher has many roles, including financer, editor, and promoter. Usually publishers have a role in establishing the boundary of the topic, too. Occasionally, this extends to dictating conclusions. Publishers often establish certain quality standards they expect of all writing they are involved in. Publishers also oversee the publication process, including the printing, or in the case of the internet, the preparation of web pages. In the information sense, the publisher may be a journal editor, a book publisher, an association, a company, or a government agency. The publisher may simply be the author. In all cases, someone, or perhaps several people, will provide the financial support, editing, and promotion for the work created by the author. An important task in appreciating information involves identifying the publisher and establishing their interests. On the web, the author may take many of the traditional roles of the publisher. The author alone selects what to publish. The author codes and places the information online. This change is neutral, though. Just as a publisher may add bias to a work, so the publisher can counter bias and drive the author towards greater clarity. Self-published works often lack the wider perspective and polish that carefully edited traditional publishing contains. Determining the potential bias of a publisher can be vital to assessing the value of an item of information. Determining some statistics on smoking habits are published by a tobacco company should at least give us pause. Thankfully, it is simple to gather such information about a publisher. The website we are on will have some information about the author and publisher as covered in Chapter 3. Context, endorsements, or a direct search will lead to the rest. The important step is recognition. As with format, learn to recognize the author and publisher. Consider carefully before spending time reading anonymous information. Vetting. Context format source, a foundation of library science. Here is how we often determine the value of information. A book prepared by an accomplished author, published by a respected publisher, and purchased through a fine bookstore is probably great. The same book, this time by an unknown author, published by a vanity press, and delivered through mail order is likely to be far less valuable. Why? Well, if the book is that great, why is the author unknown? Why the vanity press? Why mail order? A lack of indications of high quality is often enough to judge something as lacking in quality. Such vetting occurs to all information passed to us by an intermediary. This vetting is simply a selection process based upon someone's quality assessment. Libraries and bookstores wish to maximize the value of their collections, wish for this deeply. So libraries and bookstores vet the books they purchase. They check to see if they are good books before they buy them. An acquisition librarian may make an assessment based on the recommendations of library suppliers, publishers, bestseller lists, award winners, and what is local or in the news. Many libraries hand a significant portion of the vetting role to library suppliers. This sounds highly informed, but many books are still not vetted from a superior knowledge of the book. Certainly few bookstore managers have the time to read a book before they stock copies. Those who purchase books often select books because they are on certain catalogs by respected publishers, are on various bestseller lists, and because they win an award. Book publishers select the best books for publications, then put most of their marketing budget behind the most promising. Magazine editors cultivate relationships with the most interesting writers, then put the best articles on the cover. Writers report only the most interesting stories. This chain of vetting clarifies the information surrounding us by removing from view information with less interest and value. This chain of vetting spins our way information with higher quality. Vetting is not, however, fair. Not all excellent books get published. Not all groundbreaking science gets publicized. Not all interesting stories get reported. Vetting is rarely a just assessment of the facts based on expert opinion and critical thinking. Such consideration takes time and effort. Instead, vetting is often just a quick assessment based on the most obvious features of the information. Did the book author win a Nobel Prize for Literature? Is the author accomplished and respected? Do we agree with the premise? Do we like the cover? If not, let us read something else. In a very similar way, the peer review process found in prominent scientific journals and magazines displays a clear vetting bias towards established and understood achievements. These vetting chains are often deeply affected by an overwhelming range of alternatives. Over 1 million new books are published annually. Many more articles are offered for publication than are accepted. The most prominent peer-reviewed journals and magazines are vastly overwhelmed by worthy research projects seeking the publicity publication supplies. Even if we think vetting is too severe, out of necessity, vetting must choke off some worthy projects. As searchers judging quality, we should keep this in mind. The field of third world aid, for instance, has far more worthy projects than newsprint can draw to our attention. Not having news coverage does not mark an aid project as less deserving or less worthwhile. The process of selecting information may be sophisticated and informed. The people and organizations involved in vetting may have the finest motives at heart. However, this process still permits bias and uncertainty. Many a significant advance has failed to find acceptance in scholarly publications. Many a fine book has failed to attract critical acclaim or found success only after repeated failure and rejection. In reverse, some bad ideas are published in peer-reviewed journals. Even outright frauds occasionally occur. The beauty in systems of vetting is not in their perfection. The beauty is that they work most of the time and usually steer us towards better information. Vetting makes the best of a bad situation. The reason for this is that vetting may involve very little thought. Without time, most quality assessment retreats to simple questions like, what else have they done? Context. Is it a book or article I am looking for? Format. Do I recognize this author, this publisher? Source. It simply takes too long to do better. Information that attempts to circumvent our established vetting systems rarely reaches our attention. I do not read books published by vanity presses. I do not believe technological advances introduced on sales brochures. I do not believe in the quality of generic Viagra substitute as proclaimed by the intrusive spam that arrives daily in my email box. While vetting is not necessarily fair, a quick vetting is very effective at holding off the torrent of mixed quality information that invades our lives. Given the right training, we invest as much effort into vetting as we feel it deserves. Unfortunately, this places the onus on the author to approach us in a way that passes or slips past our vetting. A new discovery must convince an important peer-reviewed journal like Nature to publish their discovery. A normal article in a lesser journal is just not important enough to slip past the vetting of most scientists. Have a new medicine for ulcers? Prove the technology and efficacy to the editors and peer-reviewed boards of some of the most overwhelmed journals first. Somewhere in this onus of proof is a bridge to the field of marketing. Brand name recognition is very significant to the selling of objects. We usually do not make a detailed study into which laundry detergent to purchase. We simply don't care enough about our brand of toothpaste to undertake a detailed assessment. So it is with the information we consume. We undertake our own quick and dirty assessment. We rely heavily on the vetting undertaken by others, and we throw the onus of proving value onto the author and publisher. Let us now turn our attention to the internet. It must not have escaped your attention that the vetting of a journalist, a news editor, or a fellow reader resembles the publishing of a link or stating an internet endorsement. When I write that searchenginecolossus.com is the definitive source for regional search engines, I have vetted this site and found it praiseworthy. I considered and discarded other comparable resources. What is distinct about the internet is how short internet vetting chains tend to be and how brief the vetting. Information delivered purely on the web and not having originated somewhere else first tends not to be vetted at all. The web publishing process is brilliant in the way it strips away the need to have anything we do vetted by the powers that be. This was part of the exciting liberation of information that occurred with the internet's arrival. An opportunity for truly unfettered communication. Ideas and concepts flow swiftly, directly from author to consumer. In the process, the onus of proof of value is stripped from the publishing process. The author can ignore the task of proving worth and just get on with writing. Unfortunately, within this unfettered communication lies a lack of self-censorship, a lack of self-vetting. Consider the act of blogging, a veritable diarrhea of diary entries shoveled onto the web for all to see. To a degree, quality standards fall furthest when there is no reason to improve information. There are always counterforces at work. As the internet environment develops, a different style of vetting imposes itself on the process of finding information. Instead of long vetting chains, we use popularity ranking. In the ever-growing internet, the way we reach information becomes most telling. In a sense, we are replacing vetting chains with search tool bias. As a vast abundance of information arrives on the internet, we turn to our peers for vetting and advice on what to read. In the absence of peer reviews, we use the clues offered by search engines that recognize prominence. Beyond this, we simply choose the first to catch our eye. We simply cannot escape the confines of our system of communication. We can, at best, just push them aside for a time, as happened during the emergence of the internet, a topic for Chapter 8. Remember, we must somehow reduce the quantity of information attacking us. Our time demands this. We vet, we focus, or we invoke search tool bias. Fortunately, even when information is deliciously unvetted, free from any kind of interference, we can still tell the quality of information from its context format source. Where was it published? How was it prepared? Who published it? What else is published nearby? The internet makes such questions profoundly easy to answer. We can invoke context format source to filter results. Internet information is a microcosm of information in a larger society. Many of the facets and unique elements to the internet look far less impressive if viewed in this larger context. The change swept in by the emerging internet becomes less than truly revolutionary in this light. As we will see, it is less a marvel of construction and more a gradual evolution from times past. It helps to visualize this idea. Imagine for the moment that in addition to the earth we stand upon, In addition to the stratosphere, the air surrounding the Earth, we have another sphere that surrounds us. This is the information sphere. Don't confuse it with cyberspace, a reference only to internet information. Consider it instead as a world or realm of information. Like the stratosphere, we are embedded in it. We live and breathe this medium constantly. It is evident in everything that informs us and sells us our opinions. There is a history to this information sphere. 2 centuries ago, it was a history born of books, sermons, and newspapers. Then it became a medium of books, articles, and newspapers. Today, the medium is far more vibrant and chaotic, multi-ethnic, multilingual, yet fundamentally similar. This medium includes the CNN we watch over breakfast, the political discussion we have with our neighbor, the magazine we read during the coffee break, and the websites we view in the evening. All this joins together as the information realm. The internet represents just a part of this medium. What is the essence of this medium? It is the message. The fundamental particle is the message informing us of some point of view. This message is prepared in a particular format, a book, journal article, press release, news article, or joke. This message has an author with bias, perspective, and values, as well as a publisher responsible for editing, quality control, and promotion. This message appears in the context of other messages presenting similar perspectives and similar bias. Here we have a holistic image of a vibrant medium encompassing many formats, whereby a message is crafted, communicated, and understood. The internet cuts across many of these formats to offer an alternative digital path of communication. No, the internet is not a format in itself. That unhelpful distinction leads us astray. Instead, the internet participates in the communication of books, articles, press releases, and so on. The internet never was the death of the book, much less the death of television, as predicted in its early genesis. These formats coexist and cross-fertilize one another. When it comes to research, please retreat from the myopic view that we are searching a computer filled with facts. For starters, we are dealing with messages, not facts. Facts are somehow truthful, factual, and beyond alternative interpretation. I left that idea behind in high school and in Chapter 3. I welcome instead the notion that bias and values are embedded in most statements, perhaps every statement. Now that we have an image of an information realm, notice this realm includes a competition of ideas. The people behind the messages would prefer you read and absorb their message and not others. Some messages communicate more effectively, more pervasively than others. The first 3 messages we encounter may not be the messages we want to encounter. They may not be the best messages for us to base our decision upon. Looking at the internet as some kind of giant computer filled with facts misses this distinction. It would lead us to consider the first 3 items of a search engine results page as perhaps the most relevant. And since this is rarely so, this misunderstanding will lead us to discount the value of the internet as an information resource. The early metaphor for the internet was a library, where all the books are tossed in a pile and the lights turned off. However, with the internet full of messages, we have not disorganized information, but competing information. The order does not appear as a surface feature, but instead is embedded deeper in notions of context, format, and source. The pile of unsorted, unclassified information resolves itself into a mix of systems of communication, each centered on a different format, each system highly organized with its own strict rules and social mores. Yes, collectively this gives us a feeling of vertigo. The internet slices across many different systems of communication, so we see unrelated information placed side by side. Instead of books beside books, works of comparable authors grouped together, works on similar topics grouped together. It is as if we waltz into a public library, approach the omniscient card catalog, then search for a particular chapter from a book whose title we have forgotten. Card catalogs index books, not chapters. What to do? This image is not of chaos. To name such a library as chaotic is to first assume our search for a chapter by name was simple, and then to give up, throw our hands in the air, and cry out with blackened frustration. All is not lost. Consider context, format, source. What author would write a chapter we seek? Will it be a book or a magazine? What is the context, the subject? Even without a book title for our chapter, we should be able to find our way. We may find ourselves scanning a list of potential books for something promising. We may find ourselves thinking about what we hope to find. Both these approaches work splendidly on the internet. Both stem from thinking in terms of context, format, source. As we proceed, further approaches will stem from an intimacy with further influences in play upon internet information. I must pause this discussion here for a time. I must be careful lest I continue commenting but fail to reveal any search tactic of practical use. So let us now turn our attention to searching quickly, moving more swiftly, and shortening our journey. Later, we will take up this discussion of the nature of information once more, and, I trust, the search approaches that arise will seem accessible instead of impractical.